Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramarte Fio on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience. Apparently, Ariel and Michael aren't calling in tonight. They had said they would call in and introduce this next piece. However, they're not here, so we'll just go right to it. It was recorded, I believe, last week with Janet Farrar and Gavin Bones. So we're just going to go right in, and I think there's an announcement in here, too. Here we go.
Good evening. This is the Green Egg Five Rivers Radio Hour, and welcome to our show. I'm Ariel Montserrat, and my co-host is Michael Gorman.
That would be me.
Our guests today are Janet Farrar and her husband Gavin Bones, both of them authors, lecturers, and practitioners of neo-paganism, the modern revival of ancient, earth-honoring spirituality. Janet was among the earliest priestesses and architects of Wicca, initiated into Alexandrian Wicca by the tradition's founders, Alex and Maxine Sanders. She and her first husband, Stuart, wrote together, including the classics of neo-paganism, Wicca, and witchcraft, titled Eight Sabbaths for Witches and the Witch's Bible. Gavin Bone joined Janet and Stuart as a life partner and co-author in 1993. After Stuart's passing in 2000, Gavin and Janet married in the legal sense and went on to author multiple books and lecture around the world on earth spirituality, witchcraft, Wicca, and neo-paganism. They have an uncanny ability to stay abreast of the ebb and flow of history and provide a bridge of wisdom between the various branches of modern paganism. They live in the town of Kells in County Meath, Ireland. Janet, Gavin, welcome to Green Egg Five Rivers Radio Hour.
Hi, nice to be here.
By the way, just a correction, we got hands harvested. Next Wednesday, we are getting legally married.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, everybody, you heard it here first.
That's right.
good thing the guests know more than the hosts. That was actually going to be my first question. Is there anything in your bio that we left out that's important that you want to add?
Where should we start?
Okay, let's just say this. Stuart and I started off as Alexandrians, but we got to know the great and sadly late Doreen Valiente, who became one of our best friends. She was one of Gardner's original priestesses. And she became my mentor, teacher, and one of my dearest, dearest friends. And afterwards, getting to know her, I saw a whole new perspective on the craft. And as a result, I no longer call myself Alexandrian. Nor, I hasten to add, do I call myself Gardnerian. I just call myself a witch, exactly as Doreen Valiente did. There's a whole confusion these days over the words Wicca and witchcraft. And that's a very new thing that was not around in the early days. And with Doreen as my dear friend, we formed a lifelong bond up until the day of her death. In fact, I spoke to her literally 24 hours before she died. And I didn't realize until after her death she considered me her spiritual daughter, which was a wonderful compliment.
Wow, that is.
So I now just call myself a witch as Doreen Valiente did.
Yeah, I think that in many ways she had more to do with modern Wicca than its founder did. Amazing woman.
And one of the nicest women you could ever meet.
Yeah, it's funny. The really deeply spiritual ones usually are, you know, funny and approachable. Gavin, could you possibly, for those listeners who may not be familiar with some of the language that we're going to use in the interview, maybe give a quick definition for us of pagan, neo-pagan, witch, Wicca?
Pagan, original term is actually Latin. It was originally used to define the difference between those who worship the old gods of the fields and the woods are those who worship the new gods and goddesses of the towns and the cities. It's really Greco-Roman. Neo-pagan is really a term used specifically for the revival, and it's come to mean a whole broad type of practitioner of earth tradition, so it can range everything from people who don't actually necessarily label themselves as native to tradition, to witchcraft, shamanism, druidism, right the way across. The term Wicca came about actually really in the 1950s. It's actually even pronounced wrong. It was originally Wicca.
Oh.
But the original practitioners back in the 50s, Gerald Gardner, decided that wasn't right because they were trying to link that word with Celtic rather than Anglo-Saxon, so they started using the hard C. And so it became Wicca. Now, Wicca specifically has come to mean the modern witchcraft revival.
I like that you talked about the hard and soft C. Here in America, there's constantly an issue with people wanting to say Celt and Celtic. We can continue. Janet, you want to continue that story of the rise of the witch?
Yeah, okay. Well, I don't know how much you thought of what I was saying, but it goes like this. I ended up working for Brian Epstein's company, Nems Enterprises, and I went from there to a company called Page One Records, where I met a lot of people in show business, including Bernie Taupin, Elton John, etc. But in the middle of all of that, a friend of mine suddenly announced she'd read a book about a man called Alexander, and it was called King of the Witches. And she was going to go meet this man, and I thought, oh, Jesus Christ, here we go. Sex and drugs and rock and roll. She's into real shit. I went along to literally bail her out of it, and I was fascinated by what they were actually saying. And, of course, I was very young, very naive, and very vulnerable at the time. But I got involved with them, and I was actually quite impressed with the idea of witchcraft. And that's where I met Stuart, who was 34 years older than myself. And later on, we fell in love, got married, etc., etc. But Stuart, being very academic, had basically... in fact, you know the story of My Fair Lady? That's exactly what he did with me.
That's awesome.
He taught me how to be a lady. He took me out, wined me, dined me, educated me, etc. And as a result of that, by the time we moved to Ireland, we both looked at what the modern witchcraft movement was. And that's before we met Dorian Valiente. And we scratched our heads and said, what a load of rubbish. It was a load of rubbish.
Uh-huh.
There were some good points in it. It wasn't all bad. But it was very uneducated, very unacademic. And on top of that, there was very little spirituality in it as real spirituality. We started investigating in Ireland the old folk customs. And that's when we wrote basically our first real book. And that was Eight Sabbaths for Witches. And a lot of it was based on what we discovered in Ireland. And through then meeting Dorian Valiente through our publishers, that's when we formed this deep friendship. And as I said, Dorian became my and Stuart's mentor. And she and I formed a really lifelong friendship. And I learned more from Dorian Valiente in the years that I knew her than I ever learned from any other source in witchcraft. And it was fascinating. She really was the real great mother of witchcraft, partially because she was an academic herself. Do you know she could speak seven languages?
No, didn't know that. That's awesome.
Wow.
And
what did you learn?
A great woman. Absolutely amazing. And she was what I called one of these bitty bees. She would go from one flower to another, investigating what the pollen was made of, metaphorically speaking. She would hunt down ancient sources on witchcraft. She would go through technical journals, everything from archaeology to science, to astrology, to astronomy, to old manuscripts. And it was fascinating. It was actually, it's a bit like going to Hogwarts. She was my teacher.
Oh, man. So are you going to write a book, you know, my lessons from Dorian, what I learned?
Well, actually, there is a book that is being written about her life, which should come out in the next couple of years. I can't tell you who it's about, you know, who's writing it, because at the moment it's very sacrosanct.
Uh-huh.
But it will basically tell mother of witchcraft.
Awesome.
And this is another reason why I just call myself a witch, which is what Dory did. Although she was devoted to Gardner, and yes, they had falling out at certain times of their lives, and then she studied with Robert Cochran, who was also another well-known witch. At the end of the day, she was exactly what she said she was. She was a priestess of the gods.
Okay, that would get me kicked out of a theater just then. Sorry about that, Janet. Oh, my goodness. Yes, okay, turning phone off now. If I can figure out. Yeah, this is why I have people doing tech for me, because I'm clueless myself. Okay, go ahead, sorry. Actually, one of my next questions was, Gavin, you know, some of Janet's history, you know, you can Google, but your kind of path to get where you are is not as well known. I was wondering if you could kind of give us a sketch of that.
A lot of it is it starts with my mother, really. My mother was a very strange person. She was a converted lapsed Roman Catholic. When she was quite young, she liked the ritual. So there was this sort of, my mother was into everything. I remember when I was young, she used to go to mediums, she used to go to tarot readers. So I was used to going off to see a specific medium called Mrs. Clare, and she'd come back and tell us what had happened, tell me and my sisters. And so there was this very openness about psychic and spiritual things. So we discussed all sorts of things, everything, UFOs, some Puma, different religions, what we believed in, and I was doing that from the age of 10 with her.
That's the dream mom we all wish we had.
Right. Well, you see, when I reached that age where I started to try and work out what religion I was, what I did, doing dowsing and learning about earth magic.
Nice.
And then I was introduced, as we all know, behind every occult bookstore, there was a group.
Right.
In that case, back in the 80s, that's perfectly true. And I was introduced to the group at the back, and I was the youngest. And it was a mix of people. There was a Kabbalistic ritual magician. There was the guy I was training with, who was really into all shamanism and earth energies. There were some old-style mediums. I mean, I was in my early 20s, and most of this group were basically mid-40s plus. I was the youngest. So that was my grounding, but what my primary interest was in witchcraft. From that, by this time I was already going to the spiritualist temple as well, and I was learning about healing and how to control my abilities. From that group came the first coven I was in, which was a sex wicker coven. The thing is that we wanted to go beyond that. So we started bringing all sorts of different things. That's really my roots. But one thing about it is I also experienced at that time in the early 80s, we actually had a lot of crackpots.
Yeah,
the first,
yeah.
So the first people you meet out there are the noisiest. noisy things. Empty vessels make the most noise.
Oh, I like that. That's great.
Yeah, from that I got Gavin's first law. The first people you'll meet in the painting community will be the nutjobs.
and as druids, we meet all the people that play World of Warcraft.
Because I worked in that ritual magic group with a ceremonial ritual magician, I devised Gavin's second law, which was never trust the smiling Kabbalist. So that's how I started, but I had some very, very negative experiences. But one of the effects was that I learned about them, I realized to take those negative experiences and turn them around and realize they were learning experiences.
Right.
And one of the other things is, because I was sex wicked, I wasn't recognized. None of us were. The Gardnerians and Alexandrians around just sort of looked at us as though we were mad. You know, you're not real witches, you're not properly initiated. And they used to say, what's it? They said, Ray Buckland, you know, was drunk when he came up with Saxwicker. Actually, I talked to Ray Buckland down in New Orleans, and we were drinking at the time, which is quite amusing. and we tried to work out where that came from. He said, well, it is true, I was actually pissed when I wrote that book. And of course, pissed in America means upset.
Right.
Of course, somebody in America said, do you know Ray Bradford was pissed when he wrote that book?
And whom?
Regardless, myself and then my partner at the time, Tanya, we carried on working. We developed our own way of doing things. I brought in what I learned from the spiritualist temple regarding energy work. We carried on doing our own thing, working our own group, and lo and behold, no demons appeared and bit us on the bum. We learned to work through our mistakes and learn from them. And it worked for us. So I basically, it's interesting because as time has gone on, I've noticed I've actually gone back to a lot of the original stuff I wanted to be involved in. Pure witchcraft, the healing aspects. So I've gone like almost like full cycle in a way.
Which pretty much fits really well with the world view of most pagans, is cyclical. Right?
Yes, it's cyclical. And I realized that I had to go through those experiences. And I realized there's no real such thing as positive and negative experiences. There's only experiences you can learn from.
Yeah, my son, when he was a teenager, was always saying, it's all good, Dad. And I never believed him until later on. I thought, well, you know, if I've learned something from it, yeah, it really is all good.
Yeah. So that's the lesson I learned. So I actually did get initiated into other traditions as well, which I don't really talk much about. One of them was what's the Dorset traditional, which was really Gardnerian, although I don't think there's any what you call lineage to it. So the other thing is I have contact with some old members of Civil League's coven.
Oh, wow.
And when I met them, they were in their 70s.
So basically, one of the upshots of this is if anybody wants to know about the history of modern neo-paganism, just give you guys a call. Like you have it all covered.
I met a guy called Ron Hill. He's dead now. And he was interesting because when I went to see him and his wife, Margaret, down in Bitten, and he told me about how he'd been involved with Civil League. And he produced his book of Shadows, and I opened it up, and there it is. It's Janet and Stewart's Eighth Edison, which is where you're at now.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And I said, why have you got Eighth Edison, which is where you're at now? This is all from there. He said, well, you see, I've got to have a book of Shadows, otherwise nobody nowadays will believe I'm a witch. And it didn't have one. It didn't have any.
I love it. Janet, I have a question. Well, actually, it's a request of you.
What's that, darling?
You told me once a story about a farmer who came to you who was sent by the local priest because of
the
cattle. Yeah, the suicidal cattle. Could you tell that story for us?
Okay, let me explain to you. If you live in Ireland and you call yourself a witch, and you live in the countryside, you had better come up with the goods. Because the Irish demand proof. Well, one day, we had a knock on our front door. We opened the door, and there was a grubby old farmer. Smelly, welly boots, dirty clothes, etc. Driving an old battered four-wheel drive. And he came and he said, can I come and see you? I've got a big problem. So we brought him in and sat him down. We said, what is it? He said, my cattle are committing suicide. And we went, what? He said, no, I'm serious. My cattle are committing suicide. He said, where I live, he said, I live on a very old piece of land. There's an old monastery there with legends attached to it. And there's a little stream, sort of tiny river that runs past it. And the stream is supposed to run the opposite direction to way, which, you know, which way water should run, etc. And this is one of the wonders of our village. But my cattle keep putting their heads in it and drowning themselves. This morning, my prize bull drowned itself. So we sat him down and said, right, okay. This was not long after Chernobyl. So we said, look, have you had your cattle tested for radiation, foot and mouth disease, mad cow disease, etc.? He went through everything. He said, yes. He said, I went to the vet, and the vet tested them, and there's nothing wrong with them. And he said, I think you need to go to the priest. So he went to the local Catholic priest. And And the priest basically said, I'll say a prayer for you, but I don't know what to do. But I know where there are some people called witches. Maybe you should go and see them. And that's how we turned up on our doorstep. So we went down to this little village, and there was something very strange about it. There is a monastery, an old monastery dating back to the 1200s, sitting in the middle of a bog. Now, it shouldn't do that. It should sink. Like a big standing there. And there were all these legends about an old monk who founded the monastery called St. Sekin. Now, St. Sekin was the patron saint of lepers, and it was originally a leper colony. And if you look at it, it's a very tender little place, but very, very strange. It's got a lot of history attached to it. And we looked at the castle, and yes, you know, the castle had committed suicide, etc. And we went there, and it did not feel right. And then we spotted what was behind the monastery. It was an ancient megalithic site.
Right.
It was a huge, great, what we call in Ireland, a fairy Ra. Now, Ra, for anyone who wants to know how it's spelled, R-A-T-H. It's pronounced Ra in Gaelic. And on the letters of fairy Ra's, if there are thorn trees on them, you must never disturb the hawthorn trees. The hawthorn trees are the May blossoms. If you do, you upset the fairy folk. Well, it turned out that some fundamentalist Christians had come over from the United States. Touring around, they wanted to convert Ireland back to true Christianity, not Catholicism. They got up on the hill beside the monastery, and they had hung crosses on the fairy trees. The nature spirits were pissed off. So we said, okay, we've got to go and appease the nature spirits. Now, because it was close to St. Bridget's Day, which is the 2nd of February, the festival of the goddess Breed, Lola Breed in Ireland, we said, right, we're going to have to do certain things. His sister runs a little pub in the village. So I said to him, I want you to go down to the village pub that your sister runs, because she's also got a little shop there. I want you to bring me a pound of fresh butter. I also want you to bring me an entire bottle of Jameson whiskey. But I want you to bring me some milk from one of your heifers. Bring them back up to the hill. While he was doing that, we hung green and white ribbons off of all the fairy trees, including a specific tree in that site, which has a legend attached to it that it will not burn. It's an ancient ash tree. Well, when we went there on that day, the ash tree was dead, dead as a dodo.
Wow.
But we hung the fairy ribbons on it, we hung fairy ribbons all around the fairy rock, green and white ribbons. And we did all the, we brought him up onto the top of the hill, and we said in Gaelic that it says, Adina Shi, Akula de Darnan, Vanak Vande Darnan, Liz Agaslin. In other words, O fairy folk, people of the god, or fairy folk mean people of the hollow hills, children of the goddess Dana, the blessings of the goddess Dana upon you and upon us. And then we made him put the butter on the ground, the milk on the ground, and pour the entire bottle of Jameson whiskey on the ground. That was the only thing he almost bought that. He said, all of it? And we said, yes. So he did that.
Oh, that's so Irish.
No more cattle suicide. His cows, calves, beautiful young calves. Two swans had come back on the river, which had not nested there in over 100 years. They were building their nests and laying their eggs. And the tree that was dead, the famous tree of that entire town, had started to sprout.
Wow.
And to this day, it's still growing strong. And every year, he has to go up there and do the same offering. And in exchange, any time we go to that village, his sister, who runs the village pub, gives us drinks on the house.
That's great. I think it's really nice to know that there's enlightened priests who will send somebody to the experts when it's needed.
That thing about Ireland, the witchcraft movement here has developed differently, particularly out in the countryside, because particularly when you start to get 50 miles outside or out the coastal areas away from the towns, people here still believe in the Shi, in the fairy folk, the elementals. Shortly after the incident with the cattle, we got called down to that village again because there was a, they still do the shogri. Now that's Irish black magic. And they still have a tradition there called burying the sheaf, which takes place at the end of August or September, depending on when the harvest comes in. And what they do is they take the last sheaf from the field, make a corn dolly out of it, but it is not a blessing. They name the corn dolly as a person and they bury it in the ground, saying that as the corn dolly rots, so will the person. It's a curse. It still goes on here.
Wow.
It's, so you come across this all over Ireland, these little traditions, it's still going on.
It's actually interesting here. Some years ago, after 8 Sabbaths came out, one of the biggest newspapers in this country wrote a disgusting article calling it a sick mess of devil worship, porn, blasphemy. Unfortunately, the journalist who wrote this article confessed on Irish radio he hadn't even read the book.
Wow.
We took him to the High Court in Dublin, the highest court in the land, and we won the first witchcraft case ever in Irish history. With every newspaper having to print an apology.
That's awesome. You know, when I hear stuff like that, I remember there was some controversy about 10 years ago that we won't get into, but my first thought was like, you know, you guys are in the motherland. You're not allowed to be stupid, okay? You have to be more enlightened than everybody else. But there's idiots everywhere. But I'm glad you confronted them. Ariel, I've been kind of bogarting the question.
I have two questions.
Well, what's that?
The ash tree that had been dead, how long had it been dead for, do you know?
About 100 years.
Oh, my gosh. That's just amazing. That's really amazing. Well, okay, speaking of doing witchcraft, I wanted to ask you that, let's see, last year you published the book The Inner Mysteries, and a continuation work you began in the book Progressive Witchcraft. Can you explain to us what exactly is Progressive Witchcraft?
Okay, Gavin.
Okay, right, very, very important. It is not a tradition.
Okay.
Someone may make it one.
Introduction. Progressive Witchcraft is not a tradition. If anything, it's an anti-tradition. It was the fact that as we evolved, okay? Everybody evolves. Everybody changes. If not, you remain stagnant. And that's certainly true in our practice. And you've got to remember the pagan movement is only, what? The neo-pagan movement is only 60 years old. It's really not old compared to other religions. And we have to put that word neo on the front and stop pretending that we can actually trace it back from generation to generation. That is incredibly rare. So one of the things we were coming across is the lack of spirituality. It was like people were in covens. I'm not saying that's true with all groups, but covens. It was more like being a member of a poor man's Freemasonry.
Yeah. Sadly, that's very true.
Actually, anything about connection with the divine.
Right.
We had gone in specific direction ourselves, and we had started, first of all, to look. Janet and Stuart started with ATAPSM, which is like with a whole system of training. And we decided, well, we want to add to the existing material. And we want to say, one of the aspects of, as we began to move in connection with the divine, one of the experiences that we had from traveling around is people coming up to Janet and saying, you know, I do drawing down the moon, but I don't seem to be having the same experience as you. And one of the things we realized is that there wasn't enough training in actually how to do it.
Yeah.
People just know the ritual, which wasn't enough. It's an act of mediumship. Now, of course, I have a background in the spiritualist church. So when I was also very, because my Anglo-Saxon, which is my practice, was known as faith. And part of that was basically what's known as spay work. And that is basically a form of trans prophecy. So Jack and myself very early on started to work with that. And we started to realize that there needs to be a way of training.
I love that because you're like the old druids who used to travel around to teach people.
Yeah. Right. So one of the things we did is we began to basically use a specific term, reverse engineer as to why it would work for some people and not for others. So we created a system for initiatives for teaching drawing down the moon. And started to have quite interesting experiences with actually getting, without any doubt, full possession, almost identical to what happens in Voodoo with being ridden by the lower, by using techniques. So we realized that was really what was originally supposed to happen. Most people don't realize in drawing down the moon, if the priestess is reading out the charge, then it's failed.
Which is what Doreen Valiente told me.
Ray Buckland will tell you this, Doreen Valiente would have told you this, several of the old Gardnerians will tell you this. The charge was never supposed to be recited unless there was that really embarrassing silence because the goddess didn't turn up.
And then the interesting thing on top of that, this led into so much research on the book.
Oh my gosh,
that
yeah.
We started going into the oracles, the Pythia, the sibyls, etc., the history. I mean, for example, I didn't know when we started this book. Do you know what the word Vatican means? It comes from Vaticanus. It means seat of the sibyl.
Oh, great.
So there's a lot of history in this book as well. Not just about how to do these things, but how, from the early days, right back to the worship of Gaia in the cave, to trance prophecy across the world, it covers the whole subject.
So we developed, basically, a system called the Four Keys. Basically to train people, and part of that was using a specific technique. Now, what we started to do, now we've been doing it for over 10 years now, we've been doing workshops. We actually have groups which set up purely to do this work, where they're bringing various specific gods and goddesses as spirits, in the similar way that the lower come through in Voodoo, where they are coming through people. We've had some quite wild experiences as well with it. So we have groups in Belgium, Italy, UK,
United States,
who are all doing this work.
Spain.
So the book was really, from that we began to move on into ecstatic ritual, which was a natural part of it, using the same system. So the book covers all of this. It's a big book.
Yeah, I...
Just outside New York, there's a wonderful vineyard called the Leia Vineyard. And every year, because of what we started, when the grape harvest comes through, they do the rites of Dionysus. And boy, is it ever effective.
Oh, man.
We've literally researched the history of the rites of Dionysus. We have the Cantus singing Dionysus down. We have the ritual sacrifice where Dionysus is tied to a tree in the vineyard.
Michael would love it.
You'd love it,
yeah, it sounds incredible.
Uplifting the vines, the drummers are drumming, and literally Dionysus is covered in grapes, and the Bacchantes literally rip the vines off him and with their bare feet stamp the grapes into the ground, and it's absolutely fantastic. It looks like an orgy, but it's wonderful.
You know, I love the fact that you guys are doing this history because, you know, we talk about honoring the ancestors all the time, but so few people in the neo-pagan movement really know the history, you know, which is why I just came out, shameless plug, with my new book, which is Celtic history. We just really need to get more grounded in, so I encourage everybody who's listening to this to wait, you know, as soon as this book comes out, get it. That's exciting. That's really exciting.
Well, thank you for the plug, darling.
One of the interesting aspects is as we're going into the Wiccan history specifically, we discovered that Gardner's first initiate was actually a spiritualist medium.
Wow.
It was with her that he put the drawing down the moon ritual together. And so he's using at that time a lot of Crowley.
Yeah.
But as we researched actually drawing down the moon as a ritual, we realized the first person to actually do it in the modern era was actually Aleister Crowley. Not only that, he did it very publicly on stage.
Wow.
Layla Waddell in London. And it actually got in the newspapers with people saying how wonderful and spiritual it was.
That,
there's this long history of this tradition of trance prophecy. charge is an invocation, and they think it's just enough for them to speak as the goddess, when it's not. There is technique to it, and that's what we're trying to bring back in.
Dori Moriarty hates it, her own charge, and she told us that. She said, I'm fed up with people standing there with a book in front of them reading my charge. That's not what it's all about.
Because I don't think people hadn't realised what the charge was all about. That it was to fill that embarrassing gap.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I'm also excited that you're writing the history is we don't, not only pagans, but anybody who is interested in personal empowerment and spirituality and the environment and protecting the land, I've found this in my own research, you start finding out how interconnected the ancients were, how they traveled back and forth and knew each other,
yes,
and shared this wisdom. Everybody in the world, if you go back to a certain point, has this amazing history that's basically been stolen from us by modern historians. They don't tell this history, and it's
also been stolen by modern paganism.
Yes.
The thing of oaths and secrecy and all that. As Stuart used to say, a priest of Egypt, if he turned up in Greece, will be accepted as a priest, whether he's a priest of Isis, a priest of Osiris, a priest of Sekhmet, and vice versa. The priesthood shared knowledge.
Yeah.
You know, I've been to powwows before where I didn't even have to explain who I was, and some of the elders in the Native American community just recognized me as an elder, and there's not
exactly
a division at all.
We were in South Africa, and we spent 2 days with the Transkei Lesotho, just out in the Western Cape. And while we were there, we were made honorary elders, Sangoma. Sangoma is the traditional healers. So it's a 2-day ceremony. The first, you know, it's no different around the world. The first day was saying hello, welcoming everybody, and giving everybody a hug.
Yeah. My friend Patricia Warren, she's the one who wrote The Front Runner, the first gay love story to ever be in the New York Times bestselling list, wrote a book called Earth, One is the Sun, where she talks about this woman, Earth Thunder, at her own tribe on the Idaho-Montana border, and it had this prophecy earlier in her life that white people who were people of the circle from Europe were going to come to her at some point. And this Austrian pagan family did send a contingent over,
yeah,
to try to find a wise woman here because they'd been closeted so long. And their amazement was that the traditions were so interconnected.
Exactly.
Now, to give you an idea,
yeah,
when we had to, at the end of the second day, after the ceremony where we made honor the elders, we had to give a gift to the head elder. And, of course, we'd come from England, so it hadn't occurred to me we would have to give anything to somebody and say anything that is happening to us. So I'd already said beforehand to somebody who was there who made runes, can you make a set of runes to give so I can give them as a gift? So on the last day, I said to the elder, I've got a gift for you. She said, oh, come into the other room. So I went into the other room where she lived, and I gave her a set of runes, and I began to lay them out. I said, these were given to us by an elder, an ancestor, and he hung on the tree, and he spied down, and he gave us this wisdom. And she said, oh, we've got the same story.
That's
what?
Awesome.
You've got Odin? Oh, I didn't know what his name was. We had an elder who hung on the tree, and he got wisdom from hanging on the tree. Now, I've heard that 3 times around the world so far. It doesn't matter, we go around the world, there's somebody hanging on a tree somewhere.
Yeah.
So I start to lay the runes out. Yeah. I start to lay the runes out one by one, and as I begin to explain them, with the exception of a few cultural differences, she understood them instantly. A woman in South Africa understood the runes. And when I explained, for example, Fiao Kapo, she immediately came out with what that meant. She understood, because she was from a tribal culture.
Yeah. We had a guest lecturer up here who spent a year with the Maasai in Africa and was really excited she was going to do this really exotic ritual for a bunch of white folks, and she started calling the circle and doing all these similar things. I'm like, oh my God, we do that. Oh, we do that too. We do that. There was like no difference. It was phenomenal.
Well, I did prepare to do a workshop on spiritual cosmology. As you know, it's in mysteries.
Yeah.
And we explain that all these come from a core human experience. How the first three shamanic realms appear is from a core experience.
Right.
doesn't matter where you go around the world, there is the circle. The reason being is when somebody stands with a coat 360 degrees on their feet, the world is a circle. I mean, that's where you go.
I think it confirms that magical technology is magical technology, no matter where you're at.
Exactly.
When you're standing in that circle and you're looking where the sun is rising, and you put the sun rising basically to your right, the sun setting to your left, then you're looking to the north, in the northern hemisphere, watching. That's where the sun is completely set, and behind you is where the sun is at its height. So it doesn't matter where you go. There's always these four directions, left shoulder, right shoulder, your back and your front.
Right. Well, you know, so much of Western culture has been built on a model that is linear, and, you know, there aren't lines in nature. Two sides to every story. It's a multidimensional world. There's no two sides to anything, and yet we've been taught these things so much that it's so hard to get out of that paradigm and embrace a new one.
Everything is our ancient ancestors knew it.
Yeah.
The golden structure, spiral that you find in everything.
Yes.
Yeah.
I've actually had some really amazing conversations with quantum physicists about the similarities between mysticism and quantum physics. It's really exciting that this is happening.
Actually, when lifting the veil, I'm using the many worlds interpretation to explain how prophecy works.
Okay, so where is the vein of the earth where you keep touch with the pulse all the time? You two are amazing.
Yes, I want to know that.
We live in it.
Yeah.
Ireland is a case of we walk outside our front door. We're connected to it.
Mm-hmm.
Ireland is like that. We one of the things we say in Ireland, actually, we're out in the countryside here, we say to people, you don't have to do much magic here to make it work.
Yeah.
Michael knows, he's been here, he knows what it's like.
Yeah, if I didn't have to do any work, I was bombarded with the magic. It was. By the way, this is just a total aside, but I was just looking at my screen, and I'm sitting with a window behind me. And the way the wall and the window is positioned, it looks like I'm the Pont Vendôme is behind me, the standing stone. And then I just looked up at Gavin's picture, and there's also the same shape behind his head. It's like, wow, there really is no coincidence.
No.
I haven't got a picture of you, Dave. Not on my screen, so I don't know what's behind you.
I'll have to take a picture of it. It's pretty cool.
All right.
Ariel, did you have another question you wanted to ask?
Yes, I do. In Ireland, it has been said that the witches were in the broom closet a bit longer than in England and America. And can you tell us anything about why the delay, why there was a delay in coming out, and how do you address the issue to help the practitioners of the old ways become more open?
And that is changing, I understand. So if you could talk about that.
Well, actually, I hate to say this, the word witchcraft wasn't really used in this country until Stuart and I came here in 1976.
Not surprising.
An English word.
We came out immediately. And it wasn't that the witches were in the broom closet, it's just there were an awful lot of them around.
I haven't got a big population.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is
what we had here, we did have some of the remnants of Druid families, but they were the same ones that would go to Catholic Church on Sunday, etc.
They were some, quote, Druid families. In other words, they could trace them back, but they have no folklore.
I was told by one of those that I had to become a Christian to be a Druid. I found that pretty interesting.
Actually, if you look
talk
at
about going
Druid, backwards. Well, if you look at modern Druid,
I lost you.
Okay, well, I don't know what happened. I had not heard this tape. It was sent to me. And according to it, there's still 6 minutes to go on the tape, but there is nothing happening there. So I hope that Ariel and Michael are able to redo their MP3 so we'll be able to actually hear better and everything. And if they get that done, we'll definitely be posting it. So we're going to just play a little bit of music until the next show. Kenny's song, the show's theme, Kenny Klein. That's going to wind up tonight's show, Five Rivers, and Ariel and Michael will be back next week. In case you didn't get the announcement, because she couldn't hear or something. Yesterday, Janet and Gavin were to be legally married. So we're all sending best wishes and congratulations out to them. Now we have a little bit of music until Decide for Yourself with Clint Croucher is on.
Thank you. Salutations. Welcome to Decide for Yourself with Clint Croucher. I'm Clint Croucher. We got a good show for you tonight. We got a guest caller calling in here soon who is a community occupist out of Oakland, California. He is a great guy. He's got a lot of experiences that he wants to share with us. Real decent guy. He's a writer, a photographer, as well as a documentary filmmaker. There will be a film posted to the official Facebook page here just as soon as this show is finished. That is a trailer to the upcoming film. There will be some showings, I think he said, locally, and we're going to try to set up some showings here in Cincinnati for him as well. You know, it's my goal here at Decide for Yourself to be an avenue to get people, citizen journalists, some opportunity to get their messages heard. And, you know, that's an honor to be able to do that. First, I want to talk about a couple of things that's going on in the world right now that I feel is important. You know, China warns West that sanctions on Russia could spiral into chaos. U.S. and the EU indicate sanctions to begin on Monday. You know, people don't realize what this could spiral into. What are we heading into here? Really, we're talking about superpowers clashing now. We're not just talking about your run-of-the-mill war. This could be escalated into something beyond anything that we've seen since World War II. Now I realize, and I like to say all the time, that yeah, we're kind of in World War III already, you know, because the United States of America really has declared war on the world. They mask it and they call it the war on terrorism, but in actuality, you know, George Bush said it very clearly, either you're with us or you're with them. He made it very clear to that point. You know, and what are we going to do if it comes down to another Cold War situation? And that fear begins to spread amongst the people. And that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to spread fear, and they want us to be afraid. And they want that fear. They want that order out of chaos. They want us to come to them seeking security. They want us to come to them seeking shelter and the necessities. They want us dependent on government agencies and government programs, unable to survive and provide for ourselves. So I think people need to really grasp the full concept of what's really going on in the world. A lot of people don't know that this stuff is really going on, and when they do, it's almost like they downplay it to the point that, you know, oh, it's no big deal. I mean, how is war no big deal? First of all, war does not achieve peace. Peace cannot be achieved by war. It's impossible. It hasn't worked ever in the history of the world, you know. So why continue with the insanity of something that's clearly not working? It's something based on hate. It's driven by hate of another human. Or, you know, sometimes it's hard to put into words exactly, because why? When are we going to give up on this? When are we going to realize that war is not the answer? You know, there's no way we're going to achieve peace by war. And people are brainwashed into believing that we're going to war in the name of peace. And it's absurd, and it absolutely makes no sense to me. Something else I want to touch on real quick that people aren't very aware of, you know, the worst thing that could happen to the economy and the society is about to happen. you know, what will you do to stop it? And what I'm talking about is the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, You know, this is a trade agreement that's been taking place mostly, pretty much secretly, and the media hasn't really been covering it, of course, and that's nothing new. We all know that the mainstream media is not doing its part. Real quick, a plug for the March Against Mainstream Media coming up here on April the 18th. We're doing that in Cincinnati, Ohio, and I believe many others are doing it nationwide. We're tired of it. We're tired of the mainstream media not covering this stuff. This partnership, this trade agreement, covers jobs, food safety, environmental policy, internet freedoms, financial regulations, copyright laws, medicine costs, and a whole lot more. And for something like this to have that much authority and power over, I mean, we're talking, what, 11, 12, 13 nations now? I'm not sure exactly. I know it was continuing to grow. Involved in this trade agreement that is similar to prior trade agreements that I think sailed this country down the river. I mean, we outsourced jobs across seas to save money and so these fat cats could eat a little bit better, and it's just disgusting. And why shouldn't the American public know about this? You know, one has to ask and wonder why. Why would they want to keep this a secret? Why? I mean, it really is that simple. Real quick, before we our guest caller, I'm helping guys and getting behind Eddie, and it's on the page. And that's the Walk for Humanity here in Cincinnati, Ohio.
Okay, Clint has dropped. I'm sure he'll be calling right back in. Ah, there he is.
Sure, what happened there? I must have just dropped the call. who knows? You know, anybody could come up with a lot of theories of why some things happen. I'm not sure where we left off or exactly what cut out at, but I'm going to go ahead and continue real fast if I can to promote the Walk for Humanity, March the 22nd, downtown Cincinnati. We're going to walk from the park to Fountain Square, and we're just going to spread love. You know, we've come to the realization that that fear and negativity and hate, you know, it hurts our cause. So we're going to go out there and we're going to spread the love and we're going to hug people and we are just going to be ecstatically loving to everyone that we come in touch with. And we've got a lot of people getting involved and a lot of people coming out, and I hope that everybody will promote, and anybody that's in the local area that wants to come on out and share the love. We're collecting donations to go to nonprofit organizations like food and clothing and blankets and anything that we can do to help these starving homeless people by the hundreds that are in the downtown area that can hardly survive. And I guess just come on down. It's going to be great. You can bring your kids. Love is the key, my friends. I mean, it really is the answer. You know, love can affect a person and you have no idea. You know, you may walk up to somebody and just talk to them and tell them that you love them and give them a hug and show them that you care about them and that there's someone out here that cares about them, and you can change that person's life. You really can make a difference in that person's life, and you could really save that person's life. They could not be contemplating suicide any longer just because you took the time to talk to them and care about them and stay in contact with them and just care about their well-being. I'm seeing here that my guest is now on the air. Dan, are you there?
I'm here, Clint. How are you?
Oh, excellent, sir. Excellent. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Doing real good. Beautiful weather out here in Oakland.
Oh, now you keep bragging about that stuff, you know. I tell you, here in Ohio, it's not so great. It was two days ago.
That's what I'm hearing. Well, we'll send it in your way. Sending it your way. How's that? Blowing it your way.
Well, I hope it gets here soon.
All right.
I'm glad to talk to you. Hey, I want to say thanks first of all, for everything you're doing for the official Facebook page, all the writing and the photographs that you're contributing and stuff. It's great to have an affiliate with Occupy Oakland. I know you guys are kind of on the front line of things, and I hope to get Cincinnati on your guys' level here real soon.
Thanks a lot, Clint. Yeah, definitely get things started out there.
If you want to, man, you can go ahead and just tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got involved in Occupy Oakland.
Okay, well, let's see. Prior to Occupy Oakland, you know, I really wasn't I totally was not an activist whatsoever. You know, I'm a school teacher out here in Alameda, which is right across the water from Oakland. I live in West Oakland, one of the roughest neighborhoods in America. I love it here, absolutely love it here. And, you know, the Occupy Wall Street stuff was going on, and it sometime in November, there had been they had arrested like 700 people on the Brooklyn Bridge and all that. So here in Oakland, we held a solidarity march. You know, we had already had the camp set up and all that, and I really wasn't any part of it. But I decided to go down and support the march. So my partner and I went down there and we marched and you know, in solidarity and all that type of thing. And that's when we started seeing, you know, and you know, I've supported everything that Occupy Wall Street stood for. You know, something had to happen with Wall Street, the original message, right?
Yeah, definitely.
That original message, you know, we're always asked, you know, well, what the hell do you stand for? What are you fighting for here? Well, Occupy Wall Street, what the hell, you know, look at the original message. Somebody has to be held accountable for destroying the entire world's economy, okay?
Right.
So, anyways, going on. So we attended this march, and then, you know, I started becoming interested in watching what was going on down there. And, you know, I'd hang out a few times, go to some of the general assemblies and that type of thing, and, you know, voting and that type, and listening to what's going on, exchange of ideas, that type of thing. It was a beautiful thing. I mean, we were feeding, let's see, we fed in a three-month period, we fed more homeless in Oakland than the city and all the faith-based shelters combined did in a year. So we were doing good things. You know, we had a media camp there, library, childcare. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. Anyways, October 25th, I'm riding to work that morning. I just so happened to ride past Franco Gallo Square. We started referring it to it as Oscar Grant Plaza. And that was the morning that Oakland Police Department had come in and evicted everyone. And what I mean by evicted, they, you know, used tear gas, had LRAD sonic cannons standing by, and, you know, slashing tents with you know, pocket knives and the whole bit.
I've seen some of your photographs and you know, the trailer to your film and stuff, and it's just, some of the stuff is horrific. I mean, I can't believe that Americans let this stuff go on and pay no attention to it, really.
Absolutely. Well, and part of the problem is that, you know, they have one side of the story. You know, the people that the Occupy movement is occupying against, so to speak, are these very corporations that own the media, the outlets. They're giving the public the general, you know, the information. Oh, they're defecating in the bushes, and they're, you know, and there's rapes going on and all this other stuff. Well, you know, you're only hearing one side of a story about what's going on. So the general public, and of course the media, is only going to show, you know, black clad anarchists breaking windows and that type of thing. They're not going to show people being fed and that type of thing. So beyond that, that night, you know, so I drive past the plaza, and there are lines of cops, you know, and they're cordoning off this public square and all that. And I take a little bit of footage on my phone, right? So I go to work, come back, and on my way back, the entire downtown is just chaos, absolute chaos. Tens of thousands of people everywhere, helicopters flying around. I'd never seen anything like this in my life. As I drove up, I heard explosion. Boom! tear gas everywhere. And this is downtown Oakland. Downtown Oakland is, if you've ever visited here, you know, I know Oakland has a very bad reputation. It's a very, very scary, dangerous place. Downtown Oakland is one of the safest, nicest places you could ever go. I shit you not. Okay. So, you know, all these explosions are going on. That first explosion that I witnessed was the one where Scott Olsen had been hit in the head with a tear gas canister and knocked unconscious. So I decided to stick around, get some more footage, and something inside of me told me go right straight up front. So, you know, I for whatever reason, got right up front. I got between the line of protesters and police and started shooting with my camera phone. What I saw from that point on absolutely shocked me. And I've never had a problem with the police. Never had a problem. You know, if you catch me for doing something, okay, you got me, boom, 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 let's do this, and that type of thing. Not that I've ever been in any major problems or anything like that, but, you know, we all have our little things when we're kids or whatever.
Right.
So I've never really had a problem with the cops. I've always had the attitude of, oh, well, you know, what did you do to deserve that? Well, that day changed my entire attitude of the police department. The things I saw that night absolutely horrified and shocked me. I saw police literally aiming tear gas canisters at head level. I saw them, you know, I mean, we've seen the footage of the one cop lobbing a flashbang right in the middle of people trying to come to Scott Olsen's aid. You know, they're trying to help him on the ground, and the guy literally lobs it directly in the middle of these people trying to help him. I just saw, you know, at one point, you know, so I went through two or three of these gas things. They would tell everybody to disperse, you know, to basically ignore our First Amendment right to assemble, and shoot their tear gas, and everybody would leave. And then this incredible thing would happen where you'd start hearing through this tear gas, you would start hearing, go back, go back. And everybody went back. And this repeated a few times. They tried to get rid of us, and people just, I mean, the strength of people to stand their ground against this was incredible, and people kept going back, and I kept going back, and I kept shooting. At one point, I ran into an NBC reporter who I mentioned. I said, you know, they're shooting beanbags and rubber bullets at people, and she said, oh, no, the police have already assured us that they're not doing that. And I said, oh, really? So I went back to go get some, because there are tear gas canisters laying all over the ground.
I'm sorry. I realize it's not funny that it's horrific, but just,
no,
you know,
it is.
In that instant,
it was
almost laughable. I mean,
it is.
You know.
It is. It was surreal. So I went back to get evidence, right? I go back, and as I'm leaning down to get, you know, to get something, pow, I get hit in the back with one of these lead-filled beanbags fired from a 12-grade shotgun right in the back.
Yeah, I imagine that.
You know,
pleasant.
Oh, yeah. So I pick it up, and I, you know, I don't know what I was thinking, but I ran right up to the police, and I wanted to get my first thought was to get his badge number. And, of course, he, you know, scurried off like a cockroach into the crowd, but that's another. Anyways, that was my start of activism. And with Occupy Oakland, and in subsequent months, I became very, very involved and very, very upfront, and the quality of my camera improved. It became very important to me and very obvious that one of the things I want to say is that I got diverted away from the original message. The original message of Occupy Wall Street was to hold Wall Street responsible. And what I saw happen, and it worked on me, was that the police completely diverted everyone's attention away from that message. And I find I'm just discovering that recently, that it was like, I don't know if they did that on purpose, but it worked. Everybody started splintering, and it was the excuse my language, fuck the police marches, and it was it was all against the police. And what it did was it diverted everyone's attention away from the original message, and the media caught on to that as well and say, see, they don't know what they're talking about. They don't know what is their message, that type of thing. So in my opinion, it was a purposeful thing that the police caused this aggression, which caused people to react and diverted us from the original message. It was very effective, if that's in fact what's going on.
That's their
that's their means, you know, to use the word association, you know, and that's
absolutely
their, you know, that's their means to enforce the word association tactic that, that anarchy equals chaos. You know,
absolutely.
This is what's going to happen without government. You know, this
absolutely.
Is,
yes.
You know, so, and that's
also,
how they do that.
Absolutely. I also firmly believe that there were agent provocateurs in the crowds. I don't believe that any of the people at that protest were the ones throwing things at the police. I firmly do not believe that. In subsequent months, I saw actions where gentlemen would show up dressed as, you know, quote unquote anarchists in, you know, black and white, but they would have these big military builds and they were very, very efficient in ordering the crowds towards, you know, burning a police car or, and then they would disappear. And at the same time,
right.
The riot police would disappear. They would almost allow it to happen. And it started dawning on me that these are police. These are police,
yeah,
directing, you know, these kids and activists into committing these acts. And of course that's when the media shows up with cameras as well.
Yeah.
So
that you know, instead of if they can't stop it, they might as well try to benefit from it somehow.
Absolutely. You're absolutely,
you know, that's
right.
That's how they see it.
Yeah, and they took an angry energy and directed it exactly where they wanted to and then got the cameras on it and I hate to say it, but we fell for it. And you know, what we can take from that is we can learn from that, you know. Don't be so quick to follow someone you don't know, first of all, and think about what you're doing, you know. Think about, so beyond all this, my new focus, my focus right after that became very negative. It was very anti-police, very anti-establishment. And, you know, I still hold those sentiments. However, I found that what was happening to me is I was becoming very angry and very negative. And I wasn't accomplishing anything. So somewhere along the way, depression would set in and just anger and screw the system and all this other stuff. And it dawned on me one day, it would be a lot more constructive if I worked towards something. And how that manifested was, I read an article on a police department in Rialto, California, made it mandatory for police officers to wear cameras at all times when they're on duty. And the result was, and there's some debate on the validity of the study. However, one study suggests that brutality reports went down 82%, which is phenomenal. That's phenomenal.
Yeah, yeah.
So my attention was placed on this. What if we made this a statewide law in California? So to hold, not only require it of police officers while they're on duty to have these personal cameras, but to make the penalties for them, you know, quote unquote malfunctioning or being shut off, make them heavy fines and enforce that. That's the key right there, is enforcing these laws. Because let's face it, if we do institute this, the police will find a way around it. Yeah, that to me is a given. You know, I hate to be
at
that point, but I foresee that happening. So, you know, there have to be some catches as far as preventing this to happen. You know, an open cloud was one suggestion where whatever is being videotaped is actually being broadcast, and anyone from the public can tune in and see it at any time. So there's no chance of going back and editing or deleting footage.
Right.
So this is one of my projects today is to try to pass a state initiative here in California requiring all California law officers to do just that, to wear personal cameras while on duty.
Well, I tell you, you know, and not only, you know, I think that that's a good national solution.
I agree.
I mean it really is.
from what I can tell in the research that I've done and the studies that I've, you know, looked into about this epidemic that we're facing with police brutality tactics and just corruption in the police community nationwide, you know, this is a very simple, affordable a way to implement a real solution to the
absolutely
problem. And, you know, and hey, they tell us, they say, hey, when it comes to the NSA spying programs, if you're not doing anything wrong, you got nothing to hide. Well,
absolutely,
we're saying the same thing to you guys. If you ain't doing anything wrong, then you ain't got nothing to hide. And,
That's exactly right.
You work for us. You're supposed to. They actually work for a corporation, but they're supposed to work for us. So it should be public record their interactions with the public.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, surprisingly, I've walked up to officers on the street here, Oakland Police Department, and asked them what they think of it, and I've gotten nothing but a positive reaction from even the police. So if you look at it, this is sort of a win-win thing. It's you know, let's face it, man, there needs to be some trust built between the public and the police departments now. It's getting scary.
It's broken down, really.
In Oakland, I mean, you may not be seeing it out in middle America or you know, rural America, but Oakland is becoming militarized, man. I mean, we have armored vehicles. We have an $11 million surveillance center going in. You know, yes, the NSA has this, but now the city of Oakland is going to have it. A city is going to have an $11 million surveillance system where they can tune right into your – the police are going to be holding handheld devices where they can point it right at your cell phone and listen to what you are talking about. And I sound like a conspiracy theorist saying that, but look it up. It's right out there.
It's become a reality. It really is.
It is a reality.
It's become a reality.
People don't realize if it's happening here, it's going to come into a theater near you, man. I'm telling you.
Yeah. It, you know, there was some drug raids just up the road from me here 3 or 4 days ago. And
mm-hmm.
I live in a pretty urban area, community right outside of Cincinnati and Hamilton, Ohio, and of course I live right smack in, you know, this is East Avenue is Hamilton's 8 Mile Detroit, you know. So, excuse me, I apologize for all the coughing. I'm just getting over being sick. But yes, you know, and they were setting up to raid 3 houses, and they were all in close proximity. But and let me tell you what, it looked exactly the same as something that I would look up on YouTube and watch Afghanistan raids or Iraq
absolutely
raids.
Absolutely.
You know,
yeah,
I mean,
we're becoming used to that.
No different except there's a sheriff instead of U.S. Army, you know.
Yeah, no, we're becoming used to that here. It's standard operating procedure where, you know, you'll walk down the street and there's the FBI with the battering ram again, you know. and the helicopters. You know, I feel like, I don't know if you remember MASH, that show, but I feel like Radar O'Reilly. I can identify which helicopter is which. Is it the Secret Service? Is it the Homeland Security? Is it the Oakland Police Department? Is it the Coast Guard?
Yeah.
I can tell by the sound from miles away. You know, this is America, man. This is not the environment I grew up in, man.
And you know, people aren't informed. People aren't informed about certain things that are very important that they should be informed about. You know, I mean, you look in to certain things like executive orders that Obama had signed.
Yeah. Absolutely.
You know, you take a look at, you know, on March 16th, 2012, I'm reading here, Barack Hussein Obama signed into existence the National Defense Resources Preparedness. And that's an executive order which affords the president dictatorial powers over the nation and America, over the people, whatever he chooses to implement it. I mean,
yes, and it doesn't even have to be during war. It doesn't even have to be during war.
Yeah, that's what I was just getting ready to say. And it specifically says that, you know, it can be activated in peacetime.
Yep.
You know, and not only that, it can extend his presidency. He can continue beyond his term until he decides to undeclare this martial law. And I mean, who knows that? Nobody knows that. That's not reported on the CBS Evening News.
No, they're busy watching Honey Boo Boo and Justin Bieber's, you know, court proceedings. We're being diverted from, you know, what actually matters in this country. You know, how many people watch the Super Bowl, as opposed to how many people are aware of what the Pacific Trade is?
When more people vote for American Idol than they do for President of the United States.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's insane. That's insane. Yeah. Yeah. And to be clear, you know, I am no fan of our current president, and I'm not loyal to either party. So let's be clear that executive order is going to extend to both parties, and it's neither one is working for us at this point. Neither one is working for us.
I'm a believer, run
by corporations.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's been bought. It's over with. We've lost complete control of both parties, and it's to the point now to where it's really just an illusion. It's not two parties. It's one party. You know.
Absolutely.
And they create the infighting and the division, and it's just an illusion. Another way to divide us. Another way that I can look at you and say you're a Democrat or you're a Republican,
right.
And they've got us divided so many different ways to try to keep us from collecting, you know. And if that will that you described, you know, when people said come back, you know, when the smoke clears, come back, you know, that power of the people, and that's what they fear. That's what they
fear,
my friend. You know, it was an Edward Snowden quote that was, you know, they don't fear guys like him. They're not they're not worried about him. He's on the run. He's scared. He's hiding. You know, he's not a threat to them any longer. What he's worried about is an informed American public.
Absolutely.
You know, these people are worried about is an informed American public that's willing to stand up and come back when the smoke clears. Don't duck your tail and run, you know, because that's the power the people yield.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, one thing I saw happen that it appeared to me that when Occupy started up, there was there were talks about it, and you know, I shudder to say the word, but the Tea Party and Occupy were actually, there was some dialogue going on between them at some point, because they're both, I mean, there may be opposite ends of the political spectrum. However, they had a common message too. They're pissed at the government. Enough is enough, you know?
Yeah.
And there was actually some collaboration going on in the beginning. I don't know if anybody remembers that, but immediately that got smashed. That got, and there were wrenches thrown in between them because if I could make a prediction, that if the Tea Party and Occupy would have started collaborating on some things, we would be in a very different world right now. That would be enough. And I'm not saying that will ever happen in the future, but it seemed to me that was actually presenting somewhat of a threat. And that's why we saw a lot of the fast-tracking of this division between two sides. Now it's, you know, you're either extreme left or extreme right at this point, and the middle is just kind of there kicking, you know, dust around. I truly believe that there's a lot of purposeful division going on so exactly that does not happen. Because I truly believe that we have more in common than we have differences. I truly believe that.
Yeah, I say it all the time, you know, the majority of people, and I like to call them neutral Americans, those are the ones that, you know, some people refer to them as sheeple or whatever, but I don't really like to refer to them that way. They're just, you know, and it's always been that way. Through the history of this whole country, there's always been the Americans that really don't care who's running the show as long as they can earn a living, provide for their family, have adequate, chances at the pursuit of happiness. You know, and they just want to be left alone. They don't really care who's calling shots as long as they have a safe environment to live in. You know?
And the problem is that's changing. People aren't able to own that, to earn that living anymore, and they're not able to have that dream home. And that's what's changing in our environment today in America, is that people are starting to listen more. There's a dumbing down of America, but at the same time, you know, when people start going without and people start feeling abandoned, they start standing up. You know, like I said, I was not an activist before Occupy started happening, before I started seeing and it started affecting me personally. Then I started standing up. And I truly believe that that is going to start happening here in America on a larger scale.
Yeah, and people don't know. People don't know. They, you know, you ask somebody, hey, did you hear about the latest Anonymous rally? And they just, you know, deer in the headlights. Anonymous?
Yeah.
What are you talking about? Like, yeah, you know, it's 300 cities worldwide.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, and then they want to downplay it. Oh, a handful of people, hacktivists and this and that, you know.
Yeah.
And then with Occupy, they get smeared as stinky hippies. You know,
oh yeah, unorganized.
Right.
Yeah, everybody. Yeah, I know. I'm a teacher, man. I got a job. I know everybody I knew down there had a job. They're professionals, and you know, I there was a homeless contingency. Absolutely. Isn't that the point? Isn't that the point?
I decided. You know, I was fortunate enough. You know, I decided to make this my job.
Absolutely.
You know,
I got so
passionate. My story is kind of similar to yours. You know, I wasn't an activist. I was unfortunately, I was a product of my urban environment.
Sure.
You know, I did, you know, a lot of dirt and a lot of bad things that I'm not proud of, you know.
Sure.
But my past doesn't dictate my future, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's right.
I just became involved, what got me started was the homelessness, the problem with homelessness and the area that I'm in and the things that I see and the police harassed, you know, excuse me.
Absolutely. I've been there too. You bet. Oh, you bet.
You know,
being treated as a second-class citizen or non-citizen even.
Yeah, you know, I've got a big shade tree, you know, that was out in front of my house at the time. And, you know, the community, you know, the guys would sit there and drink their 40 ounces or whatever under the shade tree, and so they couldn't, you know, get charged for open container. And, you know, the police was trying to run them off every day. And I would come outside and try to tell them, you know, they have permission to sit there, you know.
Yeah.
And, because I don't agree with that. I don't understand, you know, what's the problem, you know, and they treat them is so poorly, and they don't try to help them in any way. You see on television all the time where the police wake, you know, the homeless person up and nudge them and stuff and get them out of their box and send them moving along. Well, that doesn't make any sense, you know.
Right.
How are you helping solve the problem by telling them to move along? He's just, you know.
It's brushing it from one place to the next. Is all it is.
Yeah.
It's pushing
and that's
off the
how
inevitable.
I got involved. And then, you know, I hooked up with some amazing friends and stuff through Awaken Cincinnatians, a group that I joined here, and we branched off into so many different things from there.
Uh-huh.
And then I got this wonderful opportunity at this show, and you know, now we're really going 100% this year, all that we can to try to get people supportive and coming out and doing things. And so, you know, this is new to me, too, but it really is my passion,
and I'm
really going into it 110%, man.
It shows, man, and we thank you for that.
Well, we definitely appreciate everything you do as well. So you want to talk about your film?
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to post the trailer to the official Facebook page. Yeah, I'm going to post the trailer to the Facebook page as soon as the show's over.
Great.
And
great.
That way people can check out the trailer. And again,
right.
I just want to say that the Facebook page is Decide for Yourself with Clint Croucher, just the same as the name of the show. If anybody has trouble finding it, you can contact me at Clint Croucher on Facebook. That is my Facebook account. And I'm sure you could probably get a hold of Mr. Burr here also. His is Danny Burr. Everything is available on the webpage, and you'll be able to listen to the shows anytime. They're archived there as well, and also some good features and stuff on that page. So be sure to check that out. But go ahead with your film, sir.
Okay, well, like I mentioned, I started shooting from that very first day. I started taking some footage, and my partner's a great photographer, Aaron Shermer, took some of the most amazing stills I've ever seen representing Occupy Oakland. And what I did is I've edited together my experience I saw and what I felt. What happened during that initial 3 months here in Occupy Oakland. The name of the film is Playground Oakland, which refers to Mayor Kwan here made a statement that she felt that occupiers were using Oakland as a playground. And I had actually wrote an op-ed, which I'll send you to post, how I felt it was quite the opposite, that it was the police who were using it as a playground since none of them actually live here. Anyways, the name of the film is Playground Oakland. It is a documentary. It is very roughly edited. A lot of that, I wanted that feel of the citizen journalist feel to it. And it basically accounts each step, each night of what happened here in Oakland. And as you mentioned, I have the trailer up now. I will have the full film up as soon as possible. Still working on the technical aspects of that. And I don't expect to make any money or accolades off this film. I just want people to see it. It is, like I said, it is my opinion. It was my observation. If you get a chance to see it, please do and spread the word. The name is Playground Oakland.
Buddy, I tell you, just from watching the trailer, I really can't wait to see it myself. I mean, and I'm a big documentary nut myself. I
right.
watch a lot of documentaries. That's just about all I watch.
Oh, great. Hopefully you like
more. And so I'm looking forward to that. And I've been talking with some of my connections here in Cincinnati. We're talking about once the film's up and going, we got some venues here in Cincinnati. We'd love to do some showings of the film for you.
That'd
you know,
be great.
Anything,
it'd be nice to even travel out there.
Do,
and,
and that's what I love about this show, you know, and this opportunity. And I'm so blessed that she's, you know, given me this opportunity because, you know, I got this show. You know, and it's not costing me a thing, and it's the possibility of how many people we can reach is really international. I mean,
absolutely.
You know, anybody can
absolutely.
Log on and listen to it, so it really is an international show if we push it and promote it to that point and get enough people listening. So, you know, and I love it. That's the way it is. Any guest that I have on the show can promote it themselves in their area and get them people listening to, you know, to promote themselves and their causes. And it's really, you ever felt like something was just meant to be?
Absolutely. Yes, I do.
Because
yes,
it's
I
like,
do.
You know,
no,
I was looking and I was looking for an avenue, you know, and mm-hmm. an avenue just like this one. And, you know, this one just fell in my lap and man, it really does feel like it was meant to be, you know. I'm real passionate
Absolutely.
About it.
Yeah, and you know, that's another thing I got to give a shout out to is citizen journalism. We had some incredible, you know, without the citizen journalists, we wouldn't know what the hell happened. We wouldn't know what happened up in Davis with the cops spraying it. We wouldn't have known about, you know, Scott Olson getting hit with the tear gas canister. We wouldn't have known about any of this if it wasn't for people on the ground with their cameras shooting this stuff. And I just want to thank everybody out there who is a citizen journalist with their cameras, everybody who shoots the police with their cameras, you with your radio show, everybody out there spreading the word and sharing information. The information era is an incredible thing.
Yeah, and I tell you what, man, us here in Cincinnati with Awakened Cincinnatians, and I'm getting ready to trademark a foundation myself.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. For voluntary community action projects, because, you know, and with this Walk of Humanity thing, we just decided to go a different direction because, you know, sure, the protests are good, the marches are good, you know, the march against mainstream media. Here, April the 5th, we have a stand and demand accountability for police brutality happening in Cincinnati, you know, and those things are good and everything, but, you know, you can only stand around, hold signs, and complain about stuff for so long,
absolutely,
you know, because we're sitting around and we're waiting for people to listen to us and for somebody else to take care of these problems and solve our problems for us, and that's just not going to work, man. The time is now to step up and start doing things ourselves. Food drives, clothes drives, you know, let's not depend on somebody else to...
Yes.
Eliminate our humanitarian issues, you know, as far as homelessness and the drug epidemics and there's just so many topics, you know. And
yeah, I know. I could go on all day, and I'm sure you could. And that's a good point, because that's why I had to step back and sort of choose. I show up to the protests, like you said. I show up to all of them. I feel my responsibility to bolster the numbers and to show support. You know, there's a difference there. A 50-man march gets attention, but a 300-man march gets more, and a 1,000-man march gets even more. So I will, if it's something I'm passionate about, I will show up. However, there for a while I spread myself so thin that I wasn't really putting enough energy into one thing. So that's why I have sort of narrowed it down and found something that I am passionate about. You know, there are a lot of things I'm passionate about, but this is one that I found a solution, and I'm putting my energy into that one thing.
Yeah, it's all, and that's kind of our theme with the Walk for Humanity, is that, you know, let's take all of our social problems and pile them all together and just tell everybody what's really, truly the answer, and that's just love each other. Love one
absolutely
another. Think about what a beautiful world it would be if hate was gone and everybody just loved and cared about each other and made sure that each and every person on this earth was taken care of. You know, the
absolutely
world
comes
be,
down to that.
You know, it wouldn't be utopia. We're never going to get a utopia, but it would be a much better place.
Absolutely. I agree. I agree, Clint.
And you know, and I don't think it's going to be long. I'm kind of a spiritual person. I'm actually a spiritual agnostic, and I believe in energies and vibrations, and I'm learning things now, you know, about matter around us and the dimensions around us and stuff, and you know, and I believe that there's a major shift coming. You know,
oh, absolutely. I agree.
A lot of people that I talk to on Facebook, you know, and via the internet and via real life, they can feel it too. The energy is growing stronger and growing stronger, and eventually it's going to boil over, and buddy, I'm going to be there for it.
Yeah. I see the same thing. I see a lot of, right now there's a lot of chaos and turmoil and discontent, and I think that's just because people are starting to see the things that are wrong, and there's a little restlessness and nervousness, but I think the outcome of that is it's a natural progression that, oh man, you know, I have a rat problem in my house. Oh shit, you know, that's the stage we're at now. But the next stage is finding the solution. You know, and I think it's this natural progression that's coming. I think you're absolutely right that people are waking up, and they're, you know, the information age. Going back to that, you know, information is never a bad thing.
Never. Yeah, definitely encourage. You know, and that's kind of what, you know, I named the show "Decide for Yourself," because You know, I don't want you to take my word for it or any of my guests' word for it. You know, I want you to go home, do the research yourself, you know, investigate these things, and then decide for yourself, you know, what it is that you really think's going on. And a lot of a lot of people just barely scratch the surface, and they're already just shocked. Like, you know, they can't even handle
in the cognitive dissonance where, you know, they find out information that goes against everything they ever learned, and they can't accept the truth because it changes their entire world. You know, it changes their entire, you know, it's just, and that's a tough one to get around, you know. All of a sudden, you know, oh, what do you mean George Washington didn't cut down a cherry tree? Wait, we've been told this our whole life, you know.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot going on in a lot of cities, and people aren't aware of what's going on, you know. I mean, it's just really sad, you know, that the mainstream media doesn't cover these things. I mean, real quick, I'd like to get your opinion, if I could. I always like to get people's opinion on topics that I talk about on the show, and I'll talk a little bit with you about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Why do you think they're trying to keep that under wraps so much?
Well, there's another passionate thing of mine. You know, that's one of the most frightening things I've ever read about. You know, the information that has been leaked on that is terrifying. This if this goes through, corporations will basically hold more power over our government, and as well, they'll be able to use the United States military to go into foreign lands and secure resources. Not that we don't do that already, but they'll be able to, you know, Shell oil, you know, there'll be a Shell oil patch on a 5th Infantry's uniforms, basically. You know, it's sort of a eminent domain thing that's happening where, you know, where they're getting rid of governments and corporations are going to replace them, this corporatocracy thing. And I don't think people are just completely unaware of it. People don't know, you know. I have one of the flyers right here. You know, some of the provisions are, you know, it'll undermine food safety protection, making it harder for countries to adopt regulations such as labeling laws or banning GMOs. They'll make it so that countries cannot ban GMOs. That's insane. They're dismantling the Buy Local movement.
I was reading that they could actually sue them.
Yes, for even thinking about bringing lawsuit, they can preemptively sue these countries. It's insane. They're going to make it so that they can't make generic pharmaceuticals in other countries. The people's lives depend on this shit. You know. It's just the laws, the things that would happen if this thing passes will make NAFTA. It's insane, and people don't know about it. You know, read up on it. Read up, folks. The Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Definitely know that there's a lot of people out there just like me and Dan that are out here trying to do everything that we can. You know, we're on overpasses, holding signs. You know, so the traffic can see, you know, what's the TPP, and there's a massive, people don't realize the massive Facebook movement. To
you know,
expose
one
TPP.
Thing, one thing I think that is absolutely essential is in how, is in educating people and spreading the information. And I want to be clear that how you educate people on these subjects is crucial. If someone comes up to me and says, "Don't eat the hamburger, you're killing beef," I'm going to eat the hamburger. It's just my natural tendency to say, F you, I'll do what I want. However, you know, I to me, the key is gently educating people on these things. You know, nobody wants to be told what to do. Nobody wants to be told what to do. I don't, you don't, we don't. But to place this information in front of people little by little you know, I hate to make it sound sneaky like that, but people want to discover things themselves. If you set it in front of them, let them discover it, it's a lot more effective, you know. Which is kind of why I broke away from the more noisy protests as well. The louder you speak, the less you are heard, in my opinion.
It's our actions that's inevitably going to bring people in, you know. And I often, you know, set it up like I'm holding one hand up and my left hand up in the air, and I got my right hand up in the air, and I say, okay, we got the protests and the activism and the marches over here, and then we got the community action projects over here on this side. And this community action projects where we're showing them that we care, and we're showing them that we're willing to implement solutions, and we're willing to volunteer our time and whatever we can to resolve the issues ourselves. That's going to draw people in, and once they're part of that loving family, then they're going to start to realize, well, maybe they do have good intentions with this other, you know, with the protests and the activism and the marches and stuff. So I think we've, you know, again, it's got to be subtle, because anything that we say now is like, oh, well, we can't listen to them because they're just crazy, you know, they're crazy conspiracy theorists.
Right. And that's you know, a lot of this stuff does sound like conspiracy stuff if you bombard people with it. You know, you throw too much of this stuff and you know, it's a little hard to process all this stuff at once. It really is. And a lot of this, you know, I'm a serious I doubt a lot of things, or try to, but when I start seeing it firsthand and experiencing it firsthand and connecting these dots, you know, from an objective point, you know, I want to tell everybody about it so bad right now, and you got to believe this because I'm seeing it. It's hard not to do that. It's hard not to bombard people with all this information at one time. Because then you do sound like a nutcase conspiracy theorist.
You know? Yeah, there's time.
And, you know, and people aren't going to listen to that.
Exactly. We're going to turn them away from the cause. Well, I tell you, buddy, it was great having you on. I look forward to reading more of your stuff and seeing some more of your film and your photographs and stuff. And again, I appreciate everything you do for the official Facebook page, the show. I hope that people check that out and read your writings, because it's real interesting and real good stuff.
Thanks.
Some of the everything, and I just want to thank you for coming on, and you have a good, great day, sir.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Clint. Thanks.
Yeah, no problem. And for the listeners, I just want to say thanks for tuning in. I hope you tune in next week. We got Carlton Brown coming back next week. He's on last week. Motivational speaker. We got some great stuff coming up in Cincinnati, some marches and stuff that we're planning, we want to promote. We'll also be discussing some other topics, so be sure to tune in for that. Until then, may love guide your actions, friends. Have a good evening and a good night.